even if they made certain concessions on military preparedness against the Soviets, they didn't view military planning as a form of economic planning, or certainly not one that should be embraced.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Security Dilemma, a podcast by the John Quincy Adams Society. I'm Patrick Carver Fox, joined by Michael Culp, as we have a conversation with Brandon P. Buck. A quick note, JQAS is holding our summer conference in mid-July. If you're a student, including a master's or PhD student, or a young professional with less than 2 years of experience in foreign policy, we encourage you to apply. If selected, we'll fly you to Washington, D.C., and you can hear from keynote speakers, scholars in grand strategy, and more awesome programming. But back to today's show. Brandon is a PhD candidate at George Mason University, with forthcoming work on the history of right-wing opposition to U.S. foreign policy and the national security state during the Cold War. He's previously served with the U.S. Army and the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, but today we're going to be talking about his research. Join us for a conversation with Brandon Buck. Brandon Buck, welcome to Security Dilemma.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
A lot of our episodes have been about very recent and rapidly changing national security issues, but today we want to have you on to talk a little bit about the history of opposition to American interventionism and primacy, specifically right-wing opposition, what you call the old right. A lot of people paint this group in broad strokes as nativist or isolationist, but as a historian and a modern right-wing critic of interventionism, what was the old right and why do they matter today?
So I should clarify, I did not coin the phrase old right. I believe it was Murray Rothbard, but it's one that, you know, is fairly, it sticks, so I can hang on to it. So the old right was called a political coalition of negation. It was the leftovers that looked askance at the New Deal. And they also were predominantly in the American Midwest, so they brought with them earlier strains of opposition to American foreign policy that emerged out of the Spanish-American War, but particularly World War I. And so they filtered that, you know, that historical inclination to maintain American neutrality in the world through their own anti-New Deal politics. And so there was a flavor of classical liberalism that was within the old right, despite the phrase, you know, a right wing. And so that's the broad strokes of who they were and what they stood for. And they very much viewed the coming of World War II through the lens of World War I. You know, within them, they had fascists that you could consider classical liberal, others that could be considered kind of small C conservative, and also some progressives, people who opposed the centralizing aspects of the New Deal. And so within them, there was a fear that entry into another world war from the liberal side would erode negative rights, right? It would subordinate the individual to the collective. You know, the more progressive aspect of people within the coalition believe that it would undermine some of this, you know, social progress that had occurred over the decades prior. And the more conservative members believe that it would ultimately hook American power to Europe. It would, you know, erode sovereignty, and that, you know, the mass impulses of a mass society for a mass war would destroy the mediating institutions that, you know, require society to work, and that would, you know, in effect corrupt the national soul. So that's the broad strokes of the political coalition that was known as the old right.
A lot of these members of the old right grew up in the Gilded Age, the late 19th century. A while back, the JQAS team was joking about putting up a portrait of Grover Cleveland in our office, in addition to John Quincy Adams. I'm curious, how would you describe these sort of foreign policy instincts and inclinations of people in that era compared to what would come about with the Spanish-American War and World War I?
Going into World War I, you know, broadly speaking, the Republican Party was the party of imperialism, and the Democrats were the party of anti-imperialism. And so as far as the GOP went, the Midwest was the progressive wing of their party, with the North being the more conservative. But that the occupation of the Philippines is what really cracks up that coalition and activates within the more progressive Midwest this notion that the war, particularly the occupation of the Philippines, was being used by moneyed interests in the Northeast, you know, very sort of Jacksonian language, right? Money, power, and all this. And so that is what got those roots started. And then later on, also with the occupation of the Philippines, particularly with Democrats in the South, there was a very similar argument about, you know, sectionalism and money and banking power, but there were also, you know, aspects of race and nativism that factored in due to the, you know, the legacy of slavery, particularly in the South, and this, you know, desire to keep non-white peoples sort of at arm's length. This also had some purchase in the Midwest, but particularly for labor reasons, there was a concern that, you know, the influx of massive amounts of Filipino labor would undermine American, you know, labor bargaining power. So those are the, you know, the broad strokes that go into World War One, and there was a political coalition between, you know, the mostly progressive Midwest and the mostly, I guess you could say, conservative or classic liberal South, going into World War One for both interests of, you know, and animated around questions of the political economy and fears that, you know, a prolonged, you know, fight in Europe would undermine American liberal values, broadly speaking.
How did the old right think about Wilsonianism from intervention in World War One and the mandate to start the League of Nations? What really drove political energy and what came out the other end? You know, once you had created this new coalition, this new, you know, Henry Cabot Lodge being more traditional and maybe William Borah being a little bit more radical, what were the motivations that caused them to be so alarmed by Wilsonian foreign policy?
Well, the thing that kept them, that kept those two factions together was this issue of sovereignty, right? That, you know, Henry Cabot Lodge was very much an American unilateralist. He wanted American power in the world to exist unfettered by, you know, multilateral security agreements and the like. And as you say, Borah was also was concerned about sovereignty, but for more radical reasons. You know, there was this fear that, you know, the stipulations of the League of Nations did not really specify what constituted individual states' territory. So it left the door open for American troops being, of course, this is what they thought, but by American troops being asked to intervene, you know, in colonial uprisings and the like. So both factions had that concern about sovereignty, although for slightly different reasons. But coming out of World War One and then solidified into World War Two, and then also into the 30s was, you know, the broad strokes of the old right, where you had some more sort of small C conservatives who were more comfortable with American power overseas, so long as it was unilateral and respected American sovereignty. You know, there was a belief that American economics and trade should drive the ship. But even there, there was some changes. Whereas, you know, a generation prior, it was the Northeast that really wanted like a modern Navy and wanted to modernize the American military. But coming out of World War One, there is a recognition that perhaps, you know, this is bad for business and we can allow, you know, free market economics to do the work of American military power. So, you know, in the Pacific, you know, of course, there was the Washington Naval Treaty, which sought to freeze European and American imperial competition in the Pacific. But between both factions, there was a desire to keep Europe at arm's length. And then there was still very much the open question about American dominance in Latin America. So that was the real one contention between these two factions going into the early 30s.
We're going to talk a good deal more later as we get a little more into the Cold War about Senator Bob Taft. But Bob Taft is, you know, as far as I understand, was a bit of a protege of Herbert Hoover. Before Herbert Hoover was ever, you know, Secretary of Commerce or President of the United States, they worked together in the American Relief Administration in World War One and then in Revolutionary Russia, in which Hoover argued that American aid would demonstrate the superiority of Western capitalism and thus help contain the spread of communism. Essentially, humanitarian intervention, providing foreign aid, was a way to prove that the American model of leadership was dominant. I'm curious how this squares with more modern right-wing critiques of international organizations and foreign aid. Was this just like, was the novelty of it meant that, like, you know, criticisms of that approach to foreign policy hadn't developed yet?
Well, I think this begs the question, what type of foreign aid and for what purpose? I mean, there had long been carve-outs within their thinking about humanitarian aid, particularly if it had some element of, you know, free market economics or private money that was being maybe managed by governments. The famine relief of Hoover in those times and also in the post-war period was considerably different than the type of foreign aid projects that came out of the Cold War, which not only sought to alleviate human suffering in terms of famine, but also was built around modernization theory coming out of Walt Rostow and stuff later on. So, you know, their opposition to foreign aid was predicated upon that, right? Like they believed it to be an outgrowth of a materialistic, technocratic view of modern society, one that could be planned from up on high and used nominally private money or private actors, but managed by the state. They saw it as a form of either socialism or kind of pseudo fascism. So in their minds, they would say that there was a difference between those, you know, those purely humanitarian impulses and, you know, and the projects that came thereafter.
If we jump now into the Second World War, how did this conservative movement, this old right, develop as the American economy was mobilized toward, you know, war goals? How did the old right think about this economic mobilization? Did it seem similar to the New Deal? Were they against the fact that America was going to war with two fascist powers?
Yes. that's the short answer. And for them, it looked, you know, it looked every bit like World War One. They, you know, they questioned the motives of the FDR administration. This was one of their leading critiques going into the war, was that Roosevelt, you know, had suffered pretty badly in the 38 midterms. There was the Roosevelt recession in 36, 37, and that they thought he would intentionally steer the American government into a confrontation in order to, you know, in order to rescue the New Deal through military means. So through the war, yes, there was very much a criticism of the war goals, but particularly with the notion of unconditional surrender, right? Because for them, at most for them, the war was a tragedy that was forced upon them by, you know, either a duplicitous administration or through, you know, sort of impersonal forces of history. They didn't view it as a great, you know, liberal crusade. And so towards the end of the war, for, you know, particularly in 45, there was this question about how the war should end and for what purpose. And so that was the big cleavage. At the end, there was a pretty important figure in the old right named Howard Buffett, father of the, you know, billionaire investor. And he was very much of the opinion that the longer that the war drew out, the, you know, the more damage that it would do to the American economy, the greater loss of life. There was certainly a fear that the rather than being a force of economic good, it would be a force of economic destruction. They carried this view of the military economy forward through the Cold War. Even if they made certain concessions on military preparedness against the Soviets, they didn't view military planning as a form of economic planning, or certainly not one that should be embraced.
One little element of the end of the Second World War that I was shocked to learn about when I read Daniel Immerwahr's How to Hide an Empire was the sort of semi-mutiny that occurred in after the Japanese surrender, where the United States military wanted a lot of the actively deployed soldiers to stay out to like stabilize the world. And there was essentially, people didn't seem to want to participate. I suppose I'm curious, because demographically we don't have nearly as many veterans in America today as we did at that moment. How did America's massive numbers of returning veterans feel about this new internationalist mandate? Did that put fire into the old right? How did that kind of culminate politically?
Well, I mean, I can't speak to individual veterans, but at least as far as like voting habits in Congress, what's interesting is that for conservative members of the Republican Party, they come out of World War II looking more like they did going in, with some acquiescence on the notion of military preparedness against the Soviets. But for liberal Republicans, the opposite is true. They transformed. Like, the war fundamentally changed them. I think like Arthur Vandenberg is probably the best example of this. He was co-architect of the Nye Committee in the mid-30s, but he comes out on the other end being a big supporter of the Truman Doctrine and the new liberal internationalist mission. And the Democrats certainly also fell in line. So that was basically the state of play for the first 20 years of World War II. More conservative inclined Republicans viewed the war through a very similar lens to World War I. And those who are more liberal or more centrist viewed it, you know, as fundamentally different, as a different kind of war. So, I mean, it's funny you say that. One of the organizations that was also changed by this was the American Legion. After World War I, they supported the Nye Committee. They at one point they actually called to take the profits out of war, which is an idea that was fundamentally associated with the American left, even though they were a conservative organization. But coming out of World War II, they weren't as internationalist, they weren't as liberal, but they very much, you know, sought to change, you know, the direction of American foreign policy thinking. So, you know, some conservative organizations, certainly magazines like the National Review, were more hawkish, more earlier. So things were up for grabs in the 50s and early 60s, very much so.
Okay, moving on to the Cold War Now, we recently passed the 25th anniversary of the founding of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization in July, and NATO will convene in Washington, D.C. to discuss the future of the organization. What would you say are the common misconceptions about how Americans have thought about NATO early in its founding and through the Cold War?
So I'd say the biggest one is that it was a sacrosanct organization from the jump, and that there was a overarching plan about how to use the organization and how to think about it in the United States. Taft was tepidly opposed to NATO. He had changed a little bit on some of his views about foreign policy, but there was beneath him, there was very much an opposition, maybe not to NATO as a political organization, but to the notion of a permanent American military garrison in Europe. And I think this is one of these conceptions about NATO is that it is a flat thing, it is an off and on switch. You're either in and you do X, Y, and Z, or you're out. But there are people who didn't see it that way, and they advocated what we might now call dormant NATO, right? Like the United States will maintain some sort of political commitment, some sort of, you know, small tripwire troops in West Berlin, but the lion's share of Europe's defense should be maintained by Europe. And this was the position of conservative Republicans going all the way up through the 60s, that, you know, especially once Europe's economy is brought back on its feet by the, you know, at least the mid-50s, like now is the time for the United States to extricate itself from permanent, permanent material commitments to Europe's security. And so, of course, Eisenhower was very much in this boat, and, you know, there's some evidence that he attempted to pull American troops out of Europe, but couldn't. So looking back on that, we've lost these strains of dissent because we think of America's relationship to NATO as, like I said, sacrosanct when it was anything but.
And I'll correct myself. I meant to say 75th anniversary, not 25th anniversary. how did the right react to the Korean War?
The short answer is that for one thing, which right, right? Because in the 50s, there were two rights. There was a Democratic right and a GOP right. So the Democrats were more or less in line with the Democratic administration. There were a few holdouts, but not very many, certainly not many worth of much consideration. But as far as the Republicans go, it split them. So, you know, we think of like the China lobby. That's the narrative that you get a lot at a conventional histories of Korea, that they were, you know, hawkish from the start, that they welcomed the conflict, and that if anything, they attacked Truman from his right, that he was tying the hands of MacArthur, and he should march all the way to Yalu, you know, unleash the exiled armies of Chiang Kai-shek and open up the conflict. And then there were people who were just below that who sort of waffled between non-intervention and further intervention. And I put like Herbert Hoover in that box. Hoover had advocated, there's some letters that of his in his archives where he advocated that MacArthur stop at the waist, you know, the narrow part of the Korean Peninsula. And so, you know, that was probably like the largest and most sizable one. These folks did not view Korea necessarily as a inherent part of the Cold War. There was some debate going on whether or not the Korean Peninsula was in fact part of the American defensive perimeter. And then there was there's a cohort just below that. Again, Howard Buffett being probably one of the more well-known names, who were against the whole war, lock, stock, and barrel. Buffett allegedly actually blamed the CIA for instigating the invasion, and they used that as a means to assault, you know, the larger Cold War project. So much so that the Mutual Security Act, which was one of the big pieces of legislation that regularized American foreign aid, that was enacted in the during the Korean War. The majority of Republicans in the House actually opposed that measure because they opposed making these certain projects permanent in the wake in the name of prosecuting the Korean War. So again, things were up in the air. Like there were sort of different factions and with different views, but going out of Korea, the old right holdouts in Congress very much viewed future, particularly Vietnam, future interventions through the lens of Korea, viewing the war as a mistake brought on about by post-war planning and also early Cold War policy.
You mentioned Herbert Hoover, and I'd love to get a little bit more into that. Herbert Hoover lived into the like 1960s and played a pretty
64. I think,
yeah. 64. Yeah. Yeah. He played a pretty big political role as, you know, like in his post presidency. I think he met with Hitler, you know, as a previous U.S. president. As far as I understand, played a decent role in staffing the first Truman administration. What was the relationship between Herbert Hoover, you know, being a mentor for people like Bob Taft, and that sort of like old right resistance to internationalism?
If anyone's looking for a really good project, a authoritative post presidency of Herbert Hoover, to my knowledge, has yet to be done, but certainly needs to be. So from my research, he's a power behind the throne. He's very much a person who makes connections between people. He proofreads speeches and books. You know, he is a political fixer. I think the you know, they called him, what was his name, Chief, I think it was his nickname. He was really big with Bonner Fellers, who was another one of these post-war non-interventionists who, you know, he'd served during the war, so he was less vocal, obviously. So during that early period when the right's trying to rebuild itself, particularly in the wake of Taft's death, he is a power behind the throne in that way.
Robert Taft was elected into the Senate in 1938 and sought the presidential, the Republican presidential nomination for the first time in 1940, and then, you know, had a series of other primary campaigns. What did Bob Taft believe about U.S. foreign policy in general, but also how did his views change between that 1940 primary and the kinds of politics that he was doing in the 1950s before his death in, I believe, 53?
Yeah. So, you know, Taft, Stephen Wertheim's book, Tomorrow of the World, is pretty good on this. And you know, once upon a time, Taft would have been considered an internationalist because, he believed in trade, broadly speaking, and legal relationships between you know, sovereign states. You know, his big hang-up going into World War II and even in the 50s was the notion of giving up American sovereignty to foreign powers in the form of, you know, multilateral security agreements, and also in the form, as we said, of you know, permanent military garrison of Europe. And you know, he did change, you know, in his later years. He opposed conscription on the eve of World War II, but came around to support it, although, you know, tepidly, I guess you could say, going into the early Cold War. And so his views has changed a little bit, and some of his rhetoric got quite hawkish, talked about a moral cordon around the Soviet Union, and, you know, trying to get the people of Eastern Europe to rise up, you know, to take down the Soviet Union internally. But as far as his policies go, 1950-51, he's basically advocating for a version of Fortress America with some carve outs in the Pacific, and Great Britain should, you know, Great Britain want to be involved for the purposes of a kind of far containment. Taft and Hoover and the old right very believed in the superiority of American economics, so there wasn't this notion that the United States had to actively ingratiate itself with foreign actors economically in order to beat back the Soviet Union. Yeah, there was this notion that the Soviets would eventually collapse under the weight of its own contradictions. So yeah, if I had to sum it up, it would be a Fortress America 2.0. He does get a little bit more hawkish with Korea. Like, once the war's started, he thinks it should be finished, but, you know, there's some vagueness there. But once he runs up against Eisenhower, then the relief between the two men becomes more stark. You know, so much so that the power brokers in the Northeast within the Republican Party looked at Taft, and even though he had moved on some things, they looked at that with horror. So that's why they went out and got an outsider like Eisenhower in order to oppose him for the nomination.
What were the Bricker Amendments, and what do you think people should take away from them today?
So the Bricker Amendments were named for, you know, John W. Bricker, a senator from Ohio, that were aimed at amending the Constitution to put executive agreements under the purview of Congress, and also to put in certain, you know, sovereignty guarantees about American foreign policy broadly. And so, you know, typically this is cast by historians, even those who were in the old right, people like Murray Rothbard. It's like the death nail of the old right. They were defeated in the Senate by a single vote. Taft had died in July, and I think the final vote was in either November of 53 or 54, I forget. But in effect, his replacement, who was a liberal Democrat, served to tip the balance. So another takeaway from that is just this notion that we think of the early Cold War as being overdetermined, but it was highly contingent upon votes in Congress and the like. So, and you know, also I see the defeat of the Brooker Amendment rather than being the death knell of a particular type of right-wing non-interventionism is in fact serving as its second wind, because you know there's a whole, like the first generation of conservative talk radio kind of gets its start in the mid 50s. You know, the old right holdouts in Congress, they bend a little bit on the issue of defending Taiwan, but then they're right back to it when it comes to Eisenhower's Middle East doctrine, other aspects of foreign aid. Rather than being, you know, the end, it's one other data point in a long, slow slide to political irrelevance, but not one that is a catastrophe.
A lot of rising stars were coming about in the late 40s and early 50s with, you know, the Alger Hiss case. And I believe Lyndon Johnson even had his own shot in the Senate at going after someone accused of communism. What did sort of McCarthyism in this environment about communism, how did that play into the old right?
Yeah, so you have to look pretty hard to find a member of the old right who was vocally opposed to McCarthy. I can't think of any off the top of my head. There were some who were privately opposed and who thought he'd gone too far, including Taft at certain times. But, I mean, they were all pretty strident anti-communists, and a couple of them, you know, intentionally just wanted to use McCarthy and his crusade against their political opponents, particularly those who they believed had defamed them during the Second World War and its lead-in. There's an argument to be made, and I'm not the only one who's made it, that the Second Red Scare, you know, sometimes known as McCarthyism, was a boomerang. It was payback for what was in effect a Brown Scare on the eve of World War II. So amongst certain people like John T. Flynn, Gerald Nye before he was voted out, but of course Martin Dies and Carl Mundt and other people in Congress, they wanted to use the fear of anti-communism as a form of payback. And so once you get to the early 50s, you know, there are a lot of people on the left who opposed, you know, the early Cold War for their own political purposes. And so in effect, coming out of the mid 50s, you know, the political spectrum is trimmed, particularly on the issue of foreign policy, due to no small part due to McCarthyism. But also, I think, you know, McCarthy in that era also shows that, you know, we typically think of anti-communism as being an outward driver for American foreign policy, that people were so scared of communism at home, therefore we had to go fight them abroad. But you had this sizable segment of the Republican Party who didn't see it that way. Like they hadn't changed a whole lot in their views of America's role in the world, despite their anti-communism. So I think, at least in my opinion, it kind of complicates that relationship.
The major figures of the old right from the death of Bob Taft on seem a little murkier, you know, to me at least. Through the Eisenhower administration and into the rise of Barry Goldwater, what was going on with the old right in this perspective on foreign policy?
Yeah, so there wasn't much of a presence in the Senate by the end of the 1950s. So once you get into 1960, it's pretty much in the House. And, you know, it depends upon how you count the votes and what you consider to be a certain level of non-intervention. But there's still about a quarter of the Republican Party who's voting, particularly on issues like foreign aid, in a very oppositional manner. So, you know, coming out of the 50s and then all the way into the mid-70s, there's really one man, and that is H.R. Gross of Iowa, who becomes the standard bearer and gives voice to a version of a fortress America in the Cold War. Strangely enough, Barry Goldwater, of all people, in 1953 was very critical of U.S. foreign aid to the French in Indochina. He actually compared the Viet Minh to American freedom fighters on the eve of American independence. So there was still a lot of juice within the Republican Party on issues of expanding the Cold War to the global South, particularly once, you know, John F. Kennedy makes flexible response, you know, a part of his foreign policy. But once you get into 64, first through attrition and then through the bloodbath that is Barry Goldwater's loss, the old Midwestern right loses much of its representation, and coming out of that, you're down to like the single figures.
I'm curious about the Kennedy administration in particular. We recently held a reading group at JQAS on Greg Grandin's Kissinger's Shadow, where he quotes Kissinger giving this, like, Kissinger is celebrating the brilliance and genius of, you know, decisive statesman actions around the Cuban Missile Crisis. On the other hand, you know, your Nixons, like another whole section of the Republican Party was kind of driven insane by Kennedy and all the fame and, you know, support he was getting. How did the old right think about, I guess, the Cuban Missile Crisis, but also maybe Kennedyism in general that, you know, Johnson would try to take the mantle of?
Well, I mean, as far as Cuba generally, there was this notion that, you know, Cuba is different, right? This is in the Western Hemisphere. It's right off the coast of Florida. You know, there was this notion that, you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis arose because the U.S. was distracting itself particularly with policy in Europe. So they often hit Kennedy and then Johnson on that issue from that angle, right? That you know, who cares about, you know, communists in Czechoslovakia or whatever when we have, you know, this problem here off the coast of Florida. But, you know, they're kind of murky on what the solution should be. It was often this notion of an outbound blockade, you know, to keep, you know, the kind of communist cancer from metastasizing in the rest of Latin America. But as far as Kennedy's program generally, there was a great trepidation amongst conservative Republicans in those early years of the Kennedy administration that his desire to, you know, what was called flexible response to move away from mutual assured destruction and massive retaliation into, you know, more clandestine programs, the use of special forces, and particularly the expansion of foreign aid, that this was going to create the conditions for future American involvement and kinetic involvement in the form, you know, of active war. So and often they mention Vietnam by name, like, you know, like, we're going to create the conditions. We're going to, you know, just like Korea, we're going to get involved in these conflicts. So, and people forget that Kennedy ran to essence to the right. And I'm using scare quotes because, you know, those labels are pretty clumsy on the issue of defense, right? He attacked Eisenhower as being too weak, right? We put all our eggs into this basket of nuclear deterrence, and we're not actively involving ourselves in the post-colonial world. So those were the lines. Those were the lines of the early 1960s.
Well, speaking of the early 1960s, that's when Vietnam starts taking a huge portion of the American imaginary about foreign policy. My impression is that a lot of conservative anti-war rhetoric got subsumed into partisan anger about these, you know, rising leftist anti-war demonstrations. How did the old right, in particular, handle Vietnam over the years as it intensified and waned and changed?
The short answer is that your impression is correct, and there's been some pretty good scholarship on this. But I think we'd have to ask, you know, which actors and when. So, you know, through the early 60s, H.R. Gross, being one of them, was very critical of U.S. support for the South Vietnamese regime, often on surprisingly humanitarian grounds. He accused the United States government of being complicit in war crimes, you know, particularly against the Buddhists there. Outside of Congress, you know, there were broadcasters and the first generation of conservative talk radio who similarly said that, you know, Kennedy and now Johnson is going to march us into this war, and it's going to be a catastrophe. Many of them view the war through a racial lens. They worried that by getting involved in Vietnam, they were going to turn it into a race war, much like how they viewed World War II. And so therefore we should keep this problem at arm's length. Maybe we should try to work through intermediaries in South Korea or Taiwan. But once you get involved in the war, unfortunately, a form of sunk cost fallacy set in. It's like, you know, we didn't want it, but now we're in it. Now we got to win it. And there was this notion that, you know, bomb them into oblivion or you know, put pressure through air power and then extricate ourselves kind of as quickly as possible. So the forces of the war itself scramble the lines of dissent. For the emerging libertarian movement, which very much had its roots in the old right, the question was clear. This was wrong from the start. This is wrong now. Conscription is akin to slavery. We need to get out of this war and get out of it now. And within the libertarian movement, you begin to see particularly strong language about American foreign policy writ large. They start to think of it in terms of empire. You often see the word imperial or empire in terms of how they describe it. And so for them, it is a birthing moment, is the Vietnam War. And through them, you know, we really do get some of the legacies of the old right, you know, their revisionist views of the early Cold War through the World Wars. But, you know, in the mid-70s is when the last of the old right retires from Congress and when most of the first generation of conservative talk radio is forced off the air through regulatory use and those kinds of things. But I should say, like, even though I'm thinking of a broadcaster, particularly by the name of Dan Smoot, who, even though they come to tepidly agree with American involvement in the war, they still maintain their revisionist narrative of how America got involved into it. And so those things were lost from the conservative media landscape in the mid-1970s. And then that paves the way for, you know, the Reagan Revolution to really build itself on this notion of a lost cause in Vietnam.
This is a angle of right-wing opposition to war that I only recently learned about. But I'm curious about L. Brent Bozell, the junior, the second. He around this time split from National Review, started Triumph magazine, and had this Catholic moral opposition to Vietnam. Did that, you know, fit into the old right view? I mean, I know that they're more constitutional. That was more about his faith. But were there really similarities or a sense of camaraderie within his conservative view?
Not that I've seen in the sources that I read, but what I do know about, you know, the Catholic opposition, it was this horror, particularly at the use of the atomic bomb and this notion of nuclear annihilation, which could, you know, should scare anybody. So there is that through line there, particularly how they viewed nuclear weapons. But, you know, one of the reasons why his magazine and others didn't take hold is because, you know, they ended in the mid-70s and they were forced out of the means of creating politics, right? I mean, it's not enough to have ideas. You have to be able to mobilize them into politics. And so, you know, starting in the late 60s, but certainly by the mid-1970s, the National Review crowd very much had a stranglehold through the American Conservative Union and other outfits. So, you know, views like Bozell's had nowhere to go politically.
That sort of Goldwater Reagan fusionism that occurred over that period seemed to kind of, you know, libertarianism was part of the things being fused into a conservative movement. Do you think that, like, meaningfully affected how conservative politics as a united force developed?
Well, it certainly cleaned house. And I just realized I just kind of made a pun talking about the House of Representatives. So it cleared the ground in a way that hadn't been done before. So, I mean, one of the things I've been looking at is election returns and trying to compare that to voting behavior in Congress. And, you know, the remnants of the old right who survived through the early Cold War didn't do much better or much worse than their interventionist colleagues within the party, with the exception of 48. 48 was a pretty bad election for them, but then they bounced back thereafter. But 64 was particularly bad because the right in general was punished across the board. So even though you had conservative Midwesterners who probably had a different stance on foreign policy than Goldwater, there was a down ballot drag that basically cleaned them out, and this helped shift the center of gravity of the Republican Party, but particularly its right wing, to the south and to the west, to a much younger conservative who had made their peace with defense spending or actually embraced it, right, through a kind of military Keynesianism. There's a reason why the phrase gun belt is often used as a synonym for sun belt. So the Goldwater moment, you know, it's like a forest fire. It clears out the underbrush and it helps to cut those sinews, those ties between the old right and the new right.
So your dissertation is coming soon, and followed by a book. If you could just describe, you know, briefly what it is that you'll be covering in the forthcoming writing, what do people have to look out for? And then we can jump a little bit more into modern implications of the history of the old right.
Yeah, so, you know, it started with a question: what happened to the non-interventionist right after its, you know, after its supposed end. And then it turned into a larger project about American foreign policy thinking, large, basic, starting in World War One and going up through the mid-1970s. So one of the things it looks at is how is it that certain ideas about American foreign policy become coded or thought of as being so-called right-wing. And so it looks at the political processes from World War One all the way through to the mid-1970s about how these camps are developed in American foreign policy thinking, not just about interventionism, but by certain flavors of non-intervention. Because once upon a time, we didn't think of opposition to American foreign policy in terms of left and right, but through the Depression, but particularly the New Deal, World War II, and the early Cold War, how we think about these things becomes coded in certain ways. And so that's the overarching, you know, theme of my work, and that's one I hope people will read and think a little bit differently about how foreign policy is discussed now, because it's when people use certain rhetoric or use certain words, they're often doing so with a purpose. It's not just to debate a particular issue, but it's to put a certain pall on it in order to make certain ideas or certain questions unpalatable, and therefore verboten.
We recently had Representative Warren Davison on our show to talk a little bit about his experience both as a veteran and now serving in Congress, where something only like 11% of members of Congress ever served in the military, whereas at the height it was something like 70% in the 1970s. How has your experience as a veteran informed the kinds of questions you're asking, the approach that you're taking to studying this period in history, and the way that you think about U.S. foreign policy today?
Ooh, that's a big question. So,
I know, sorry.
So where to start? So I am a veteran. I also served in the intelligence community for about 6 years. I did a bunch of deployments to Afghanistan, became pretty disillusioned with what I saw and kind of with the bureaucratic processes that one only sees if you left the hood, right? If you're actually in the belly of the blob. And so one of the things that interests me is, you know, bureaucratic inertia. How is it that bureaucracies, particularly national security bureaucracies, become victims of their own momentum? Because I was very much there when people were talking about like West Africa and, you know, like this is the new frontier. This is the new frontier of American counterterrorism. And I was always like, maybe we should just win the war we're fighting now. Like there was an absence of realism in terms of how counterterrorism policy was discussed. And in some ways it's very similar to the way liberal internationalists thought about communism, right? They thought about it, communism, as a material problem, one that could be solved through planning, particularly through foreign aid. And so, in a lot of ways, there are parallels to that with the way that the war was prosecuted in Afghanistan and Iraq and elsewhere. That, you know, terrorism comes up from poverty. There's social, you know, there's inequality. We need to solve this through planning, and, you know, and so there are those parallels there. And so, you know, how I got to this project is those are some of the larger themes that I'm interested in.
Conservative restraint seems resurgent today. You know, huge names at national conservatism conferences, perspectives currently being taken by organizations like the Heritage Foundation, and pretty universal anger and disgust at the Bush administration. I'm curious, from your perspective, where is conservative restraint today compared to its heights and, you know, pits that you've studied?
It's less coherent than it was, probably because, you know, the political forces at play are considerably different now than they were in the 1930s. And, you know, there are some interesting parallels, right? There is certainly a Asia first element amongst some aspects of it. So it's interesting to see the, like, Europe, or the question of American stance in Europe is that's almost like the one agreed upon thing. And then the rest is up for grabs. So, you know, I would caution about putting, you know, too firm of a model from the past onto the present, because it doesn't quite comport. There are some interesting, you know, parallels, like I said, you know, but certain policy issues. But one of the things that's interesting is this rejection of, you know, the neocon vision for what America's policy should be, that, you know, and that is the kind of universalist notion of American modernity and American politics. And so seeing that being rejected is interesting, because in that was, you know, not only was that the neoconservative vision, but it was also one that was more or less embraced with Ronald Reagan. It's debatable about how much he actually adhered to that in terms of policy. But since the 70s, you know, that's been more or less the, you know, a conservative idea, right? That that America is a shining city on the hill, and we should work through certain means in order to spread that abroad. So seeing that gone is an interesting development. And, you know, had you told me 20 years ago that some of the most ardent, you know, opponents to the war on terror had been from the right, often people who fought the war themselves, I would have considered that to be, you know, fantasy. But here we are.
Do you think the old right and more modern libertarian, or I guess nationalist, resistance to primacy are coming from the same place?
I think there's a stronger through line with the libertarians, because for one, there is a continuity in those ideas that goes from Congress to the early libertarians of the 1960s down to the present. I think with the paleoconservative or the illiberal right, or the, you know, whatever that is, I mean, we can debate about what the contours of that political coalition. I think that's a little murkier, because, you know, those threads were really cut. I mean, yes, you had the Rockford Institute in the mid 70s in Chronicles magazine, and then Pat Buchanan in the early 1990s, but to my mind, there's, you know, that political coalition is a little more incohate, particularly on issues like trade and tariffs and the like, you know, what to do about, you know, China and the Pacific. So of those strains, I would argue that it is in fact the libertarians who are the most coherent and have this, you know, the strongest unsevered thread to the past, at least to the aspects of the old right that were, you know, classically liberal, right? They had some differences, right? Taft was pro-tariff and these kinds of things. But as far as this notion of empire being destructive to American liberty and the American political project, I think that is something that is clearest in the current libertarian movement.
We have a number of different hosts from the JQAS team, you know, come on to do these interviews with me and John. But today we have Michael, who served in Iraq as a Marine and then later on in the Air Force. I'd love to ask actually Michael just quickly, how is what Brendan has been describing match with your experience? I believe that you were on one of the ships during the initial invasion of Iraq. I mean, do you think the Iraq and Afghanistan experiences are meaningfully different, or do they fit into a broader blend of the war on terror?
That was with the 24th Marine Expeditionary Unit on the USS Nassau during the invasion of Iraq. I think Iraq and Afghanistan, the experiences are probably different, and it's kind of a mix, like what you said. I think there's a big difference between those who probably served during the initial invasion and then went home and got out, like myself, versus those who later came in 04, 05, 06, some of the time, you know, some of the worst fighting in Iraq. So, and then Afghanistan, obviously with the 20 years perpetually, you kind of had kind of like a up and down where it would, you know, it would get hot, then cold. But I think what Brendan, especially when he talks about us not staying focused on, you know, the current wars and looking at Africa, that was an eye-opening experience for myself back in 2010 when I was in the Air Force Reserve and I deployed and we were flying missions all around Africa. So like for a good example would be Manda Bay. You know, Manda Bay was attacked January 5th, 2020. I was in Manda Bay in the summer of 2010 multiple times. That was Camp Simba, which we weren't allowed to talk about back then. That were special operators operating out of there. You had a single strip. You had to land, engines running, offload, onload, and get out of there. And where I would say where the different places we flew around in Africa that was kind of eye-opening to me is I kind of said that we paid tribute to these countries that we were delivering aid to, because we would land, we would have large sums of cash that our pilots would carry, and they would have to go in and negotiate a price to offload that plane. That's completely separate than paying for fuel for the plane when we were done. So, you know, we might be paying thousands of dollars to get this plane offloaded, and they have their workers come out. And I had one experience in the Congo where the crew was out there helping us unload the plane. And I guess you could say it'd be the crew's foreman came up to me and asked for payment. And we had already had briefings on how to, you know, discuss this with them. And it was basically, hey, I don't pay you. You're going to have to talk to your boss about this. And that was kind of like when I realized, I'm like, hey, these people are unloading our plane and they're not getting any money. They're not even getting paid for this. That's more likely. Or if they are, they're getting paid very lightly. But yet we're giving somebody, you know, whoever we're negotiating with, thousands of dollars to offload this plane. So that was very, that was very eye-opening for me. It made me start questioning a lot of things of what are we specifically doing in Africa? What are our missions here? And I could see back then in 2010, how spread out we were, but how, if we were back here in the States, American public, we were completely, nobody knew about it. I mean, nobody would have known about Manda Bay back in 2010, unless you'd been there.
Yeah. For me, it was a combination of seeing the daily kind of waste, fraud, and abuse that one sees in government, but also witnessing Yemen, Syria, the expansion of the wars under the Obama administration, particularly the toppling of Gaddafi, and then, you know, the arguably attempted overthrow of Assad, and then the expansion of the war in Yemen. And for me, it was like, well, what's going on here? We were promised retrenchment, and we're getting expansion of the war on terror. And so for me, that soured me on the two parties, because it's like, well, what's the difference here? If we're going to get intervention either way, then we need to look for political solutions outside of the two party system. So, seeing, like bureaucratic incentives to expand the war at the macro level, but also the micro level, right? Like that conversation I had with a colleague earlier. You would meet military commanders who would intentionally drive up their operational tempo in order to improve their standing to their commanders. I mean, these things kind of happen up and down the chain of command. So seeing all of that, that's what for me got me soured on the whole project and helped, push me out the door. But in retrospect, seeing this seeing this politically mobilized, it's interesting to me, because you're seeing within the populist right now, they're taking what had traditionally, what's often been called mid-American radicals, is a phrase Sam Francis used, this disdain for, the managerial class, whatever you want to call them, the kind of middle managers, the blob, the deep state. But now the right is mobilizing that dissent at the national security blob, at that level of government, government operations and employment. So that, to me, that's interesting, because that's something that we haven't seen in this country since, I don't know, arguably the mid-1930s.
In the last decade or so, the language about a war on terror has gotten back to the much more reasonable idea of great power competition, where we would now get to, challenge China, who is certainly, I don't know, less capable than the Taliban or whatever. I suppose, what would the wisdom of the old right be about great power competition as we're seeing it today? Like, if we were to, resurrect some of these perspectives, what do you think they would see in modern Russia, modern China, and the American national interest?
Well, I think the argument would be to pick your battles and to accept a form of multipolarity in which you have a stable, client in Europe, and then you fixate yourself on containing China. I mean, this is pretty much what they advocated for in the 50s, but also to have a more realistic goal of what that means. Does that mean to defend American, territory, or does it mean to spread liberal democracy? If it's the second, then that's a much heavier lift, right? And that is, in fact, how, the Cold War was prosecuted, and in my opinion, how the war on terror was prosecuted. If it's the former, if it's merely through, if one's concern is merely the, the maintenance of American, territorial integrity and, freedom of maneuver in the world, then that is, again, it's a daunting idea, but it's certainly less daunting than taking a universalist idea of what that mission should entail.
Brendan Buck, this has been a great conversation. Thank you so much for coming on Security Dilemma.
Thank you.
Security Dilemma is a podcast by the John Quincy Adams Society. To learn more about our programs, visit our website at jqas.org. Apply to the JQAS Summer Conference by May 7th. Remember to rate and review on your podcast app and join us every Tuesday for new episodes of Security Dilemma.